And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman has the day off. Today we learn more about a report which assesses the economic impact of the University of Miami on the South Florida region. It's actually around the equivalent of the cruise ship industry. Joining me now is the U's Senior Vice President for Business and Finance and CFO, Joe Natoli. Welcome to you, Joe Natoli.
Good to be here.
Also in the studio is Fernand Armandi. He's the managing partner of Bendixson and Armandi International, and that's the firm that conducted the study. Thanks for coming by, Fernand.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
Joe Natoli, why was this assessment needed?
You know, it was just an opportunity to step back and look at the economic impact of the University of Miami to South Florida. We have done this every several years. The last time was in 2007. A lot has changed in the world over the last 5 or 6 years.
Including a big-time recession.
Including a big-time recession for the University of Miami. We purchased Cedars Medical Center. We have expanded. We have invested. And we thought that this would be a good time just to sort of take stock in that and see what the impact was on South Florida.
It's hard to believe that UM's economic presence is as big as the cruise industry with all these thousands and thousands of people coming in every Saturday and leaving on Sundays.
Well, you know, we're a large local business, and we are a local business. And so the vast majority of our impact is in Miami-Dade County and in South Florida. We have 13,000 employees, which makes us the second largest private employer in Miami-Dade County. We've sort of bounced up and down with the folks with the pineapple. I think they may be the largest by a little bit right now. We have $2.4 billion a year in revenue and expenses. And again, almost all of that is generated in and reinvested back in the local economy.
Tell me, Fernand Armandi, about the methodology and how you went about making this survey, this report about the economic impact. There's a lot of different influences that you have to take into account.
Sure, and you know what we did is we took a look at the books over the university's fiscal year, the last fiscal year, and by way of direct and indirect economic impact, these are the two metrics through which you can make an assessment of what an institution or what an entity contributes to the, in this case, the local economy. And Joseph, it was just a remarkable number. I mean, we do these sorts of studies on a regular basis for varied clients around the region, around the country. But, you know, to see an institution that is directly responsible for, on an annual basis, of over $6 billion, just a remarkable number. And, you know, to think that that's one of the anchor institutions in this community. Joe talked about the fact that it's one of the largest private employers. But you know, when you contextualize what that number means in terms of direct impact, over six billion dollars every year, and that's in a conservative model, just looking at the direct and indirect expenses associated with the university in the fiscal year, just a remarkable figure.
What was the most surprising aspect of UM's economic impact that you came across?
Well, you touched on it earlier. I mean, there's no doubt that over the last 3 or 4 years, the American economy, and by extension the local economy, has seen a contraction. We're obviously in a week coming out of a very weak recessionary period. But in spite of that, against the backdrop of when this study was last done in 2007, UM's economic impact increased by a margin of over 24% from 2007. So in the backdrop of the Great Recession, while other industries, while other businesses were either laying off folks, contracting folks, and obviously lessening their economic footprint, the University of Miami was increasing. And I think that's part of the reason why in South Florida, certainly, a lot of families, a lot of businesses and entities were not maybe as impacted as it could have been, thanks large in part due to this university and what it's contributed to the region.
Well, compared to some of the other major educational players here, such as FIU mm-hmm. and Barry and Miami-Dade College, most of the students at UM are probably from out of state.
Yeah, currently three-quarters of the 15,000 students at the university come from outside the state. That's something that has evolved over time. If you were to go back 20 or 30 years ago, we would have been far more of a a Florida-centric institution. And so that's really one of the similarities to the cruise line, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. Three-quarters of our clientele comes from outside the state, and the difference is they stay. So they're here for, you know, 9 months of the year. Their families are coming. Their friends are coming. So it's we don't even cast off.
And perhaps off-campus housing.
Off-campus housing, and, you know, their friends and relatives come for athletic events, for events on campus, for homecoming. And so it's not just the 15,000 students. It's their extended networks that are brought to South Florida.
Joseph, you know, one of the things that from that particular point that you mentioned, the out-of-town students that come and the money that they otherwise might not have brought into the region, you know, this is one of the stories that you go beyond the numbers and you look at what is contributing to this. And I think this is fascinating because we actually saw evidence of this, not so much directly in the numbers, but as you begin to piece together the story. And I think what's happened is as the university's impact and reputation has increased nationally, and there's no question that over the last 10 years that has happened. You look at the way it's ranked and regarded as now one of the top universities in the country. One of the economic consequences of that is that it's doing a better job of attracting top-tier students from all around America and in some cases all around the world. As Joe talked about earlier, the institution was a little bit more Florida-centric in the past in terms of the composition of its student body. But what has happened is, with the accolades, with the direction, and really trying to make it a top-tier institution, as I think it's now being reflected in some of the rankings and some of the other metrics, you're seeing students from around the state, around the country, and around the world come to the University of Miami, and the South Florida economy is the beneficiary of that.
What's a typical tuition semester fee for a student at UM?
Tuition would be in the high $30,000, and then it's plus room and board. That's if you're paying all of the costs.
Right.
In many cases, the university provides some subsidy based upon need.
And how about scholarship funding, foundations, grants, and I guess that's a very active part of the development department.
It is. I mean, the average undergraduate at the University of Miami receives about a 30% subsidy from various sources. And, of course, that varies. There's a bunch of folks that are paying the full boat, and there are a bunch of folks who are getting the benefit of some support. Over time, that's something that we would really like to address through the fundraising. I mean, we would like to be able to meet the needs of any applicant who applied to the University of Miami, had the SATs and the other background that would be necessary to get in, which is getting increasingly harder with each year.
How big an impact does the sporting events at the University of Miami contribute to its economic impact? I know they're going through travails there that you don't have to talk about, but in fact, they should have an announcement today or tomorrow, I think. But
well, I'll stay away from that specifically, but, you know, athletics is a very important part of a university, and certainly of the University of Miami, and of the overall student experience.
The long tradition.
And the long traditions, and we're proud of it. And, you know, our branding, whether it's the health center or athletics or other parts of the university, is the U. And we are known far and wide for being the U. The revenues and the expenses associated with athletics are actually a very small part of our overall revenues. You know, there are some big dollar.
Of course, in the public's perception, though, it's such a big part.
Yeah, I mean, there are some big dollar athletic programs around the country. It tends to be places that own their own football stadiums and pack them with 100,000 people for their games. It tends to be in small communities, you know, where most of the activity revolves around the school. In our case, there's a lot more competition for people's time and so forth. And so, you know, University of Miami athletic programs have historically been overachievers relative to the amount of revenue that comes in the door.
Fernand Armandi, tell me more about the report and how long it took you to come up with all these facts and figures.
Sure. There was a period of about 3-4 months where, you know, it was the task and the arduous task at that of working with Joe and the good folks at his office to really just aggregate and take all of the numbers and all of the figures and kind of put them in through the recognized model for these sorts of studies. And then once that was done, it was kind of interpreting and arriving at the conclusion and making sure that, you know, that number fit very much into what the metrics were indicating. And then taking that that big number and putting it into context. And, you know, speaking earlier, you talked about the issue of athletics and perception. I think you think about $6.1 billion, and, you know, it's certainly a big number, but what does it mean without the proper context? Here in South Florida, it's a community that, you know, is accustomed to every few years, if we're lucky, you know, getting the Super Bowl. And it's undoubtable and undeniable that the Super Bowl brings economic impact. But when you think about the impact, you know, studies range from anywhere from $300 to $400 million based on a given Super Bowl in the modern era. The University of Miami's economic impact per year is the equivalent of 20 Super Bowls coming to South Florida every single year. So all the fanfare, the perception about the role that the Super Bowl plays, and it's undeniably an important
one. So that's per year.
But that's per year. It's the equivalent of 20 Super Bowls every single year coming to South Florida. So I just think when you think about the magnitude of what that number is, and, you know, there's a lot of attention now. I know there's a proposal out there to try and raise an additional $400 million in the hopes of attracting a Super Bowl, with the idea of maybe getting it every 4, 5, 6 years, which, again, wonderful for the region if it happens. But by contrast, University of Miami every year, and that $6.1 billion, it's the equivalent of 20 Super Bowls every single year. Just a staggering figure.
We're speaking with Fernand Armandi and also Joe Natoli. We're talking about the impact of the University of Miami on the South Florida region's economy. Let's take a short break. We'll be back with more. And we're back, 21 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Joe Natoli. He's the UM Senior Vice President for Business and Finance, and also the CFO. And also we have the managing partner of Ben Dixon and Armandi International, Fernand Armandi. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Tell me a little bit, Joe Natoli, about student loans. It's a hot topic with many young people now. I have interns here that are so far in debt before they ever get out of school. How does that affect the university's economic picture?
You know, I mean, it is an emerging issue, I think. You know, the University of Miami, because of the improvement in our brand over the last, you know, many, many years, and in particular in recent years, we've become a hot school. So we applications continue to grow. I mean, we currently receive close to 30,000 applications for a fall cohort of 2,000 slots. And so
30,000 apply for 2,000.
For 2,000 slots. Mm-hmm. And so it's become quite competitive to get in. And students then stretch to make it work at the University of Miami. And they borrow the money that they can. They go to their relatives and so forth. Over time, one of our real priorities is...
Does the university get any cut on these student loans?
No, I don't believe so. And so over time... what we want to do is be in a position to meet those needs. So we have the Momentum 2 campaign. There are a number of priorities for fundraising for that campaign, one of which is to be in a better position to meet the needs, the need-based needs of students.
Again, our telephone number, 1-800-743-WLRN. How about the impact of the university on the city beautiful Coral Gables?
Now, it's a huge impact on the city of Coral Gables. In fact, the percentage of, I don't remember the exact percentage, but the percentage of UM grads that make up the Coral Gables population is a very large percentage. Like when we had a meeting with the mayor, and he mentioned how impressed he was by that, and President Shalala said to him, remember that the next time we ask for something. So, you know, George Merrick years ago said that great communities and great universities go hand in hand. And I think that is really true. And I think it actually extends beyond the limits of the city of Coral Gables, and it extends throughout South Florida. But in particular, the impact of the University of Miami on Coral Gables is really terrific. People come to Coral Gables. They have a great experience at the University of Miami. They look for opportunities to stay. And in many cases, they do that.
I think we need to address also the impact of University of Miami and its relationship, which is sometimes controversial, with Jackson Memorial Hospital and some of the layoffs and things that have been going there. Tell us a little bit more about the economic impact of that.
Sure. I mean, the university has had a 50-year relationship with Jackson Memorial Hospital. It's where we do most of our medical teaching. That's a very important relationship and will continue to be in the future. We do many of our finest programs at Jackson, and that will continue. The university had some we had some cutbacks in our healthcare operation over the last year. They were not in clinical care operations. They were really focused on unfunded research and administrative expenses. The healthcare business is not an easy business. Reimbursement rates are coming down. There is more pressure to offer high quality in a very efficient way. And the university, like lots of other places, needed to react to that and then continue to manage the business. You know, the healthcare institution, the healthcare part of our operation represents two-thirds of the University of Miami. So when you think about, I mentioned earlier, we're $2.4 billion in revenue, healthcare-related, whether it's clinical revenues or research or philanthropy at the medical school, represents $2 out of every $3. So as goes the medical school financially, so goes the university. We must run that part of the operation in a very high quality, very efficient manner.
How about the School of Law? Does that bring in a lot of donations and philanthropy? Or
I mean, at all different levels. I mean, even going back to the issue of the cutbacks in the medical school, of course, those were not factored into the last impact study because it was taken from the fiscal year prior. We actually did the exercise just to see for ourselves what the impact was, and it, you know, was negligible. It doesn't take away from the painful decision I'm sure the university had to make to do so, and those jobs that were had to be let go. But the impact was negligible in the broader picture. And I think, as Joe mentioned, one of the things that for us on the research side, looking at it, you know, with the cold eye that the researcher does, is just to see how medical is really part of what is responsible for this growth. We talked earlier about a 24% increase in economic impact against the backdrop of the Great Recession. Part of what is driving that was this expansion into the healthcare field, how the university has gone into new areas and diversified its pool of potential resources. And that, in and of itself, is part of what is creating this great economic story that you see reflected in these numbers.
Let's take a call or two. We've got Christian. She's in Miami Beach. Hi there.
Hi. You answered part of my question. In talking about revenue and impact, two-thirds of that is the medical is the medical program. I was just wondering, when you did this study, did you compare it to any other institutions in higher education, like the college, Miami-Dade College, or FIU? And if so, what were the differences?
Well, I mean, there have been a couple of publicly released studies, and you know what we see is by comparison, and they don't necessarily. You know, they're not apples to apples because in some cases they were done from different years.
I saw
years.
One from FIU from 2010 that showed like $1.4 billion.
I was going to say, but, you know, almost by a factor of four, the University of Miami's economic impact is much larger, much more robust, and at least according to the numbers we looked at, affecting a much broader footprint, a much wider footprint, both geographically and in the diversity of where that those dollars are impacting. So I would say clearly in terms of the schools in the region, the comparable four-year universities, far and away the largest and the biggest in terms of its direct impact.
What are the biggest differences economically between a public institution versus a private one such as UM? Thanks for your call, Kristen.
Oh, thanks.
You know, I mean, I would say the local student versus the out-of-state student. So the fact that three-quarters of the University of Miami student body comes from outside the state, those are additive dollars to the local economy in a way that folks who are already living here, spending
staying
money
with their parents.
Yeah, would be less so. The other thing is, I mean, University of Miami has been growing as a private research institution, so you bring, in our case, several hundred million dollars of new dollars into the market that are used to create new
Where does
jobs.
Where most of that research money come from?
It comes from, you know, the National Institutes of Health, other government organizations, private companies for drug studies, and so forth and so.
The drug companies themselves?
Yes. I mean, so it is all new dollars coming into the local economy, and, you know, most of the money is spent on people.
And Joseph, you know, just to show you, we talked earlier and touched on how the conservative nature of the numbers in terms of what the potential is. One metric that was not taken into account that, you know, I'm sure will might be considered in the future, but you look at the visitors that come to the area as a result of the University of Miami. And this is not about, you know, jobs and the medical school and the student body and all of the elements they're in, but visitors that are generated as a result, whether it's parents coming to visit or other folks, conferences as a result. Those numbers and those dollars, more importantly, that are spent as a result of University of Miami-generated activity are not taken into account. So there's even an exponential effect, an extrapolator effect that you're not necessarily seeing in this number. So the potential is even larger than that $6.1 billion at a conservative level.
Fernand, how about a website where people can go and see the study?
The university actually has published the entire study on their website. I think they can access it very clearly there with a link. And you know, you'll see with a breakdown by all metrics, indirect, direct, just how robust this economic impact was and is.
And one more caller before our next segment. This is William in Miami Lakes. Hi.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. My question is regarding medical residents. Medical residents have a salary that they're paid. But I know that these funds, as far as I'm aware, I should say, these funds don't necessarily come directly from the teaching hospital. They actually come from the government. And my question is, what is the amount that is actually allocated per medical resident that the government gives the university, and then what the university actually pays out to the resident?
Okay.
Obviously, once you finish taking an hourly, let's say, wage, if you will, you're working for pennies.
Well, Joe Natoli, is there an answer you can give him? We're very short on time.
You know, I don't have a good answer to that question. I would say most of our residents are at Jackson. They're technically employees of Jackson Memorial Hospital. Our folks supervise them, and then we work out through the financial relationship with Jackson, and that's about all I can
answer. I'm sure there's a lot of complications there. Well, I certainly want to thank you. We've been talking about the University of Miami Senior Vice President for Business and Finance and CFO Joe Natoli. And also in the studio was Fernand Armandi, the managing partner of Ben Dixon and Armandi International. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Joseph.
Food and Dining is next. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you this afternoon. Bonnie Berman has the day off. And our food and dining segment is now on the air. Joining me now is my longtime friend, chef, author, syndicated columnist, Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, most everyone wouldn't mind dropping 5 pounds or so, but what's the best way to go about it and also to keep it off?
Well, there's the question.
There's the rub.
But here's another question. Who doesn't want to look and feel younger? How about that? You know, can we do it? And how can we do it? Well, our guest today says, yes, we can. And she's going to help us drop 5 pounds as well. She's Melissa Derabian. She's TV, Food Network star, best-selling author, and host of her latest show, Drop 5 Pounds. And she has some tips for us for achieving the Fountain of Youth.
That's I could really use maybe 10 or 15, but I guess I'll live with 5.
Whatever. Welcome, Melissa Derabian.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great. We're anxious to hear your guidance for us. And we'd also love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for our guest? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
And also with us, our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. So, Fred, what's in your glass today?
Well, I thought I'd talk about whether wine is good for you and see if we can come up with some answers.
Can I guess what the answer is from you, Fred?
Well, not entirely. I might surprise you a little bit.
It was supposed to be one glass a day or something like that.
Who right? knows?
Yeah, well, okay. I know. They chintz out on us, don't they?
All right, let's go to Melissa DeRabian. Melissa, let's go straight to it. How can we look and feel younger? Where do we start?
Well, you know, it can be overwhelming to suddenly say, how can I feel younger? How can I, you know, lose, you know, the baby weight or whatever? And that's what I love about Drop 5 Pounds. It really focuses on looking at the small steps that you can take that over time will lead to big results. And that's the idea of Drop 5 Pounds. A lot of people say, oh, well, I have more than 5 pounds to lose. But, you know, you don't lose 20 pounds in one day. So focusing on the 5 pounds in front of you is a great start.
And that's a great idea. You know, I mean, I think that that's what we need because, as you say, it's overwhelming. I've got 20, 30, 40 pounds to lose. Just think small first, small steps. Great idea.
You know, and starting and doing, you know, a little bit at a time, it really is true that, you know, you have to start with one step, put one foot in front of the other, and don't be so hard on ourselves. You know, we can be so critical and so, you know, we can get into the mode of, oh, you know, I've got extra 20 pounds, or I've got extra this, or I've got that, or I'm not looking as young as I want to look, or whatever, and we get so wrapped up in our criticism that we get into such judgment of what it is that we end up doing. So, you know, I think one of the number one things that we can do to look younger, feel younger, meet our weight loss goals is to stop judging ourselves and see information and feedback as just that, information and feedback. So I always say to people, well, you know, if you want to, you know, start to be a runner, I'm making it up, but just running is a very measurable thing. You know what? What you need to do is put on the running clothes, put on the running shoes, and go out and run. If you run a quarter mile every single day, then that's okay. Don't judge that. Just do it, you know, to quote Nike, right? There's a reason
right,
why
just
that's a great
do
slogan.
It. So tell me
do
something.
Do it anyway.
Right, so tell me something then. What are your foods that are supporting, you know, that support our fountain of youth?
Well,
I mean, is it just the foods that we always hear about, or,
no.
or have you got
no,
some
not.
New ideas?
I've got some new ideas. And you know what? And they're not mine, right? This is, you know, all backed up by, you know, bodies of science and research and, you know, and good housekeeping. And they really stay on the front of, you know, all the research out there. So this, to be clear, is not just me, you know, doing some wizardry in my own kitchen and telling you what works. But that being said, here's the good news. We've been told for so long that in order to lose weight, we really need to not eat fat. And we are finding out that healthy fats are not only more satisfying, but they actually support weight loss. And the great news is that healthy fats also make us look and feel younger. So if you can focus on the healthy fats with the omega-3s, if you're looking at the, you know, the nuts and the seeds, the avocado, the fatty fish, the salmon, if you can look at those healthy fats, not, I'm not suggesting the fatty beefs and going out and having, you know, chicken wings and pork ribs and then saying, well, that's
whoa,
that'll
whoa, slow whoa, down. Slow down now.
You're really hitting Joe in his stomach. You're hitting him there. So Melissa DeRabian, I'm so glad you've mentioned fats because people say, oh, I can't have that. It has fat in it. But an actual fat facts is what, you know, canola oil or olive oil, you know, the monounsaturated fats are good for us. But you also mentioned to me at one point that some foods pump up your skin by adding collagen. What did you mean?
You know, if you eat lean meats, you know, if you're looking at the, you know, the boneless, skinless chicken breast, and here's a surprise, pork tenderloin. A lot of people are surprised to find out that pork tenderloin can even have slightly less fat and saturated fats than a boneless, skinless chicken breast. So, but you know, a lot of people go right to the boneless, skinless chicken breast, which is a great go-to. It's fast. It's inexpensive.
Boring.
But, you know, sometimes you want to mix it up.
Melissa, give him a recipe that's not boring. And also, I feel that people could I use a lot of boneless, skinless chicken thighs. People kind of stay away from
there
them, but
go.
They have much more flavor. So Joe is saying, yes, that's okay. Give him a recipe that's going to make him happy. with
yeah,
chicken.
Yeah, see if you can have some sausage in it.
That's perfect. That's exactly what I'm going to do. You know, and actually, I'll tell you what. We're joking, but you could take some low-fat sausage and, you know, for instance, I make a roasted vegetable pasta, and I use whole grain pasta, I use roasted vegetables, and I use just two sausage links, and you could get a low-fat sausage and make that for your whole family and get some of the flavor. If you're smart about it, you can use sausage for a flavoring element, not as your main protein. So, you know, even sausage, you can work it in. You just have to, you know, compensate and be aware of what you're eating and perhaps not eat five sausages for one person, but maybe two sausages and low-fat version for the whole family. For roasted, for a pork tenderloin, we make on Drop 5 Pounds a balsamic roasted pork with berries, and we turn it into a salad. Now, berries are a fantastic fountain of youth item to have on your shopping list because they have more antioxidants than almost any food out there. So the antioxidants are going to help with, you know, skin, you know, with where your skin looks, with cell repair. So berries, you know, also full of vitamins and low calorie and refreshing and tasty and a little bit sweet. So the berry is probably, you know, one of the perfect superfoods that you should have on your shopping list if you want to lose weight and feel and look younger.
Okay. So, and you also mentioned that exercise is an important part of dropping your weight. We mentioned, you know, get out there and walk, even if it's for just 10 minutes. Start somewhere and start walking or running. So, but do you have some fat-burning exercises that are really good?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's this misconception that you need to go out and, you know, and do a full hour of exercise. You need to carve the time in. You know, that's the common piece of advice is schedule it like you would schedule any other meeting. And while that is very good advice, for me, I fall a little bit short on that. And new evidence is showing us that even several chunks that are shorter but are intense can still give you a lot of the benefits. So, and in fact, there's some evidence to show that if you do, say, 3 10-minute spurts of exercise, that you may actually even be getting more out of it than if you do 1 30-minute spurt of exercise. Why? Because if you only have 10 minutes, who doesn't just give it their all? They think, oh my gosh, I've only got 10 minutes. I've got to give it my all, and I've got to break a sweat, and I've got to really go for it. And it's hard to go for it at that intense level for 30 minutes straight. So don't feel bad if you need to break it down into smaller chunks of exercise. Okay. That's totally okay.
All right. And then, you know, we socialize. Most of our socializing is eating out. So what are some do's and don'ts for eating out?
Well, you know, there's eating out at a restaurant, and then there's eating out at parties. And there's also hosting parties. That's also a big part of socializing, at least in my world. I've got a couple of tips for the party goer. One is use a small plate. Usually they've got small plates and big plates at a party. Pick up the small plate. Even better, just take a little BevNap and put a little portion onto your BevNap or onto your plate, and
what
then
do you say? Sorry, you're talking a BevNap?
Oh,
like
a
cocktail napkin.
Okay,
yeah, cocktail napkin.
Just
yeah,
wanted
yeah,
to make
yeah.
sure.
I'm sure Fred Tasker uses those all the time for him.
Oh, all the time, yeah.
Well, here's another.
That's so classy, right?
Here's another thing at a party that I always find: don't stand near the buffet table and talk to
well,
a friend.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Walk away.
Yeah.
You make your own little buffet on your little cocktail napkin, and you walk away. And now you've got a healthy little buffet there for you. Here's the other thing: if you are going to someone's house, you know, offer to bring along a little appetizer. Most hosts are happy to have you do that. And so now you're bringing along, you know, maybe you're making, a really protein and fiber-rich hummus and bringing along your own veggies. And now you actually have one option there that you know is super healthy.
It's going
healthy.
To be great. Well, Melissa, this is great advice always. But we're going to go for a break now. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest today is Food TV star Melissa Darabian. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Food Network star, best-selling author Melissa Darabian. Her latest show, Drop 5 Pounds, premieres its second season this Saturday, January 19th. And she found her way to TV by winning season 5 of the Food Network's The Next Food Network Star. She's been giving us some wonderful tips on how we can look and feel younger. I have a message for people with diabetes or for anyone who has a friend or relative with diabetes, and that's a free webinar. It's next Wednesday, January 23rd at 8 p.m., and it's called Diabetes Delicious Dinners, and I'm going to be hosting it. And we're going to talk about getting great diabetes-friendly meals on the table. And
of course, you've written about that.
In minutes. Yes, I have 2 books out. Mm-hmm. So if you want the link, go to dinnerinminutes.com. It'll give you a link to the free webinar for next Wednesday. All right, dinner in minutes time. So we're going to give you a quick and easy, younger-looking recipe. And it's roast pork. We mentioned the roast pork, pork tenderloin earlier. It's roast pork with hot pepper succotash. And this pork takes only 15 minutes to make, and it has a sweet and spicy dry rub. For the rub, I just mixed together some ground cumin, ground coriander, some cayenne pepper, and brown sugar.
And you must have butterflied this.
No, you know, you can do it that way to make even less time. What, did you eat it so fast you didn't notice? Okay, it's a pork tenderloin. Rub this dry rub on it, put it under the broiler for 10 minutes, turn it 10 minutes. Now they have a new rule. The USDA, it's 145 degrees the pork is done. It used to be 165. So with it, you have a hot pepper succotash. Now, all you do is you take some frozen lima beans, some frozen corn kernels, and cook them a little bit of chicken broth, add some hot pepper jelly just to coat the vegetables. That's it.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah, it's a 15-20 minute meal. That's it. Complete recipe and photo is at dinnerinminutes.com. And then if you're looking for another pork recipe, Dijon pork with pepper tomato pasta, it's in today's Miami Herald. So, by the way, all my recipes fit the government nutritional guidelines. Please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Well, Joe, you ate it.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And it's gone.
It's hard to believe it's less than 15 minutes to prepare, though. But
I'll give you 20, Joe.
Okay.
So as long as you use the loin, it can be lower fat than chicken even?
It can be. Absolutely.
Boy, oh boy.
All right.
And I'm just going to jump in. You're really looking for the word tenderloin, because there's also just regular pork loin. And I always tell people, if you're paying $1.99 a pound, you have pork loin. If you're paying $5.99 a pound or somewhere up in that range, that's how you know you have the tenderloin.
Tenderloin is it. Let's go to Fred. He's going to give us some wine suggestions.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose the question here is wine good for you? So I Googled that and came up with a number of websites, from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to the Mayo Clinic and a number of others. And I got a lot of different advice, conflicting advice, but I came up with some general guidelines, I think. First, a 5 ounce glass of wine, which is a nice substantial pour. Like if it's a white wine like Chardonnay, it has about 100 calories. And if it's a red wine like Merlot, it probably has about 106. And this compares to 100 calories in a can of light beer, or 145 in a can of regular beer. So regular beer has a lot more. And then a standard 1.5 ounce pour of most liquors, that's what you'll get in most bars. If it's 80 proof, it has 97 calories. And at 86 proof, it has 105 calories.
So, Fred, do you just drink a 5 ounce glass of wine for the day?
On occasional days. maybe not every day.
Well, here to make you happy, the American Diabetes Association allow men to have 2 5-ounce pours a day. And women win.
Yeah, that sounds like sexism somehow, but I guess it's based on science.
I guess so.
Anyway, you don't want to do cola. Well, a can of diet cola has 8 calories, but a regular cola has 135. And then, of course, if you go to do dessert wines like port or ice wine, in which they have purposely left a lot of sugar to make them sweet, that can go up to actually 250 calories. So the question is all this good for you? And the Mayo Clinic says that if you're a healthy individual, wine can cut the risk of heart attacks, lower the risk of gallstones, and some medical websites even say it might protect against diabetes. But most of these, as Linda was saying, most of these websites limit alcohol consumption to about one glass a day for women and two glasses a day for men. And more than that, of course, you're risking your liver and other valuable internal organs, and not to mention driving drunk and that sort of thing. Of course, the other problem with wine is that it can be a powerful appetite stimulant for a lot of people, to the point that some nursing homes actually give people a glass of wine if they're undernourished or if they have poor appetites. They give them wine to stimulate the appetite. So there goes your diet.
Why it's called an aperitif, right?
I guess so,
appetite.
Yeah, so in the end, it comes down to the same old tired advice that was handed down to us by the Greek philosopher Aristotle, the Roman dramatist Publius Terentius, the Bible in Philippians chapter 4, verse 5, and probably your own dear old mother, moderation in all things.
You had to go to the Greek to get your wine there?
That's right.
Okay.
Well, they were major league wine drinkers, so they knew of what they talked.
Yeah, of course. Melissa Darabian, do you ever talk about alcohol consumption and drop 5 pounds?
You know what we do, and in fact, we sort of talk about how do you navigate those waters, pardon the pun, when you're socializing. We in this season we'll have a recipe for a sangria where we add just a little bit of brandy, a little bit of sugar and orange juice, but a lot of seltzer. So we've got some cucumber in there and lemon and orange. So it's going to be visually very pretty, but you can take your one glass of, of wine allotted and, sort of stretch it into something a little bit bigger and more satisfying. I'll tell you, seltzer water can do a lot to stretch your alcohol calorie. So that's sort of our trick there. And the other piece of it is, hey, you know what? If you're at a party and you want to have more and you're not the one who's driving and you want to have, three, count the calories and compensate. It's just that simple. It's about not beating ourselves up. But it's, the small steps we take every day are so much more important than the big steps we take occasionally. So if you have a habit of watching, your alcohol consumption and your calories and all that, it gives you permission to treat yourself every now and again.
Right, and I think the idea of seltzer is great. I mean, if I'm going to party, sometimes you have a very long cocktail hour. I'll have, white wine spritzer, just a little white wine and some seltzer and a little lemon twist, and that'll carry me through.
I like the idea of letting yourself off the hook once in a while. I hate these these columns that talk about how to eat Thanksgiving dinner for 300 calories or something. That's just silly. You can diet the next day.
And I'm going to agree with you. I also think that we have this tendency to have this really long view of, oh, I did horrible, so the rest of the week can just go downhill. If you sort of see each day as being compartmentalized and sort of say, okay, well, I had, I'm going to have Thanksgiving dinner, this afternoon, so, maybe I'm going to eat a little bit healthier this morning. It's all really about what you were saying, Joe. It's really about, self-love. Well, you weren't saying that. I'm paraphrasing. But it's really about us enjoying things. You talked about the chicken thighs and you enjoying that more. We need to understand that we cannot succeed in feeling better about ourselves and dieting and feeling younger, looking younger, whatever the positive change is, as long as we are berating ourselves and telling ourselves that, oh, we did something quote unquote bad, or we did, we're not good because we ate, had a third glass of wine or whatever. Compartmentalize. That's over. What's next?
Okay.
The best tool I can get people is, what is next?
Well, that's on that note. We could talk on and on about this, but it's been another tasty week. Melissa Darabian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Catch the second season premiere of her Food Network show, Drop 5 Pounds. It's this Saturday, January 19th. And you can find your fountain of youth. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph?
How's the weather up in Michigan, Fred?
We had a blizzard yesterday. I love it. Today it's only spitting a little snow, so it's keeping it nice and white and clean and pretty.
Well, it's raining here.
All right.
Oh, and it hit 50 in San Diego, so I feel your pain.
Well, next week, we'll be talking about French Bordeaux wine with Monique Seyon from Chateau La Seigue. And we're getting some French food to go with it from Pascal Houdin from Pascal's en Pons. Well, join me then. I'm Linda Gassenheimer.
And thanks for listening this hour. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction today from Paul Leary, who is also online producer. We have free audio archives and digital downloads of past programs at our website, WLRN.org. You may also follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Like us. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and a live jazz concert from our studios. They just tuned our Steinway piano. Monday, we return with sociologist Charles Durber and his book, The Surplus America. And to the calendar. On this day in 1874, 139 years ago, the deaths of the original Siamese twins, Eng and Chang Bunker. The conjoined pair bought a plantation in North Carolina and even owned slaves. Florida's former CEO and gubernatorial candidate Alex Sink is a great-granddaughter of Chang. And on this day in 1899, 104 years ago, the birth of one Alphonse Capone in New York City. He tutored under gangster Johnny Torrio. One more before we face the final curtain. On this day in 1977, 35 years ago, death row inmate Gary Gilmore gets his wish and is killed by a firing squad in Utah. Get this, Johnny Cash sang a song to Gilmore over the phone just before the execution. We leave with a thought from Al Capone, once a resident of Biscayne Bay's Star Island. Quote, when I sell liquor, it's called bootlegging. When my patrons serve it on Lakeshore Drive, it's called hospitality. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 90.